How does someone get to be in charge? There's lots of ways you could answer that, right? You can talk about the process as in a business. So in a business, a lot of times your education matters, your experience matters, and a lot of time who you know matters in terms of eventually getting to the top, being in charge. When it comes to governmental authorities, we know that how you get in charge, you get elected. But of course, that's not the whole story, because how you get on the ballot is a pretty long process. How you get to that point of being elected is a long process. But that's in terms of our elected officials. That's how they came to be in charge. It's important to know who's in charge in a lot of situations. So if someone isn't getting compensated rightly at a job, need to know who's in charge so you know who to talk to in order to rectify that situation. If I disagreed with a police officer over getting a ticket, I need to know who's in charge, how to deal with that. If I just say, I disagree, so I'm not going to pay the ticket, that's not going to work. But there is somebody that I can go to a little higher up the food chain. I could have my day in court. I could argue my case. And the judge would then arbitrate that disagreement. But in all those cases, you have to know who's in charge. You have to know also that you're not in charge in those cases. So when it comes to the subject of right and wrong, it's also very important to know who's in charge in order to determine what is right and wrong. This last week, I read an article from the Journal of Medical Ethics. And this article was arguing that the abortion of newborn babies should be viewed the same as aborting unborn babies, or to use their word, fetuses. And can you heard that correctly? The argument is they're justifying what they admitted was the killing of unborn or of newborn babies. They admitted that that's what they were describing. And they said that they believed that that was okay because a baby who is in the womb is essentially the same as a baby who's just been born. And by their definition, they didn't feel that either of those babies, which they would have termed differently, but either of those bore the characteristics of being a person. So they were saying they're essentially the same. They should be thought of the same. And because it's right, in their opinion, to abort, to kill something that they don't deem to be a person, if they make that same definition for a child who's been born, they're not a person, they can be killed, and it would be considered right. So keep in mind, this is the Journal of Medical Ethics. What they're talking about is what is right and wrong in the field of medical research and practice. They're talking about what they believe is right and wrong. And what they're saying is that killing what they admit is life is okay, both in the womb and right out of the womb, if that's what the mother wants. That is the argument that's being made. Now, should we be surprised at that? No, actually, we should not be surprised at that. Because this practice that they're doing, it's the same thing that we humans have been doing for a very long time now. Ever since the beginning, in fact, this is what humanity has done. Ever since Adam and Eve chose to reach out and say what God said was wrong is okay for them, that's exactly what we've been doing ever since, trying to determine right and wrong for ourselves. We have been doing what is right in our own eyes, as the book of Judges puts it. So how are we supposed to evaluate what's right and wrong? Who's in charge when it comes to determining what's right and wrong? So for those of us who accept the fact that there is a God, and we believe that this God has spoken to us through the Old Testament prophets, and particularly spoken to us through the incarnation of his Son and his ministry and through his apostles. And for those of us who believe that this Bible is the inspired word of God, so that the word that God has communicated to us, we know who's in charge. We know who determines right and wrong. But even after that knowledge, even after we know who determines right and wrong, we can disagree with God at times, can't we? We can disagree with what God says or with what God does. We can have a hard time saying, I'm not sure that's right. And we would listen to those that wrote in the Journal of Medical ethics with horror. We look at them and say, that's crazy. But we're still willing to question God in the same way and put ourselves in the same position of determining right and wrong and saying, God, I'm not sure you're doing what's right here. When we question God, what we need to ask is, who's in charge? And that's what we see in Matthew chapter 12 this morning. Jesus is going to give us three reasons why he's in charge. And he's going to do that through this controversy with the Sabbath. You can go ahead and turn to Matthew chapter 12. And he's going to give us these reasons to show that he's in charge through this controversy over the Sabbath. So it's helpful for us to look back at the significance of Sabbath. It's an understatement to say that Sabbath was important for the people in Jesus' day. We need to think about their situation. Let's suppose we had been taken over by another nation. So we've been taken over by another nation. America is now under the charge of some other nation. What would we hang on to in order to maintain our identity as Americans? What would we hang on to so that we didn't get absorbed into another culture and just cease to be what we are? What might we hang on to? That's the situation that the Jewish people were in for hundreds of years before Jesus came. They had been conquered by the Babylonians. And then the Babylonians were absorbed by the Persians. And then they were subsequently taken over by the Greeks. And the Greeks, in particular, they tried more than anything else to assimilate the Jewish people into their culture. And if it wasn't for that old covenant law that said you can't do this, you can't do that, then the Jewish people would have been assimilated and would have just become like the Greeks. But because they affirmed the law, they knew that the law told them to do certain things, that's what actually maintained their identity. And so there were certain things in the law especially that became really important to identify as Jewish. I'm Jewish. I'm different. And so three things became especially significant. Circumcision, only eating food that the law said was okay, and keeping the Sabbath. That was one of the ways that it marked you off and said, I am not this a part of this culture that's in charge. I'm distinct. I'm a part of the people of God. So Sabbath was very, very important for the Jewish people. It was one of the key things that set them apart. And it was so important and so obviously important that there were Gentiles that took advantage of that. They knew that the Jewish people weren't going to do anything on Sabbath, and so they exploited that. So you have the Roman general Pompey, when he was going to storm the Temple Mount. So what had happened is he had taken over Jerusalem, but there were Jews that had not given up. They had not surrendered, and they went into the temple complex for protection. And he waited until the Sabbath to storm the temple because nobody was standing guard on the Sabbath. That's how seriously they took the Sabbath. So Sabbath is extremely important for the Jewish people. But there's a problem with the Sabbath because the Sabbath laws are not that specific. The fourth commandment says that you can't do any work on the Sabbath. But it didn't go into a lot of detail as to what work was. So to enter the Jewish people, the Pharisees, they were the kinds of people that were scrupulously obeying the law or trying to obey the law. And so they wanted to make sure that they didn't do anything that the law said you couldn't do. And in order to do that in these areas that weren't specific, they built a hedge around the law, so to speak. That's kind of the image. It's like you build hedgework around your house or something to kind of keep things off of it. They built a hedge through rules that they kind of inferred from the law so that they wouldn't get anywhere close to breaking the law. And so when it came to this idea of not working, they wanted to spell that out to make sure that they didn't get anywhere close to breaking the Sabbath laws. And so it's actually a later Jewish work called the Mishnah, but it shows the kind of thinking that was at work in Jesus' day. This is what it says. It says, the main classes of work are 40 save one. So 39 classes of work. Here they are. Sowing, plowing, reaping, binding sheaves, threshing, winnowing, cleansing crops, grinding, sifting, kneading, baking, shearing wool, washing or beating or dyeing it, spinning, weaving, making two loops, weaving two threads, separating two threads, tying a knot, loosening a knot, sewing two stitches, tearing in order to sew two stitches, hunting a gazelle, slaughtering or flaying or salting it or curing its skin, scraping it or cutting it up, writing two letters, erasing in order to write two letters, building, pulling down, putting out a fire, lighting a fire, striking with a hammer, and taking out aught from one domain to another. You know what it sounds like? It sounds a lot like the end of the prescription drug ads. Well, this is And they did, why did they do that? They made that long list because they want to make sure we're not going to transgress the law in any way, shape, or form. So we're going to list out all these things. Don't do all these other things that the law doesn't actually specifically say. But that's how they interpreted it. And so you can imagine what went through the minds of the Pharisees when they saw Jesus' disciples do what they did here in Matthew chapter 12. Look at verses 1 and 2. It says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. But when the Pharisees saw it, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. Now, when we read this, I think what we often automatically, at least if you're like me, you automatically assume the problem is theft. They're walking through somebody else's grain field, and they're taking their grain. But that's not the problem here. God had actually encouraged a different attitude among his people. He had given a law, actually a law that stated to the owner of that field that he needed to allow them to do that. In fact, Deuteronomy 23:25 says, if you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. You can take some of it. You can't harvest it, but you can take some of it. And so God was encouraging his people to look out for each other. So theft was not the problem. The problem was that Jesus' disciples had done this on the Sabbath. And so as far as the Pharisees were concerned, they'd worked. They profaned the Sabbath. They had broken the fourth commandment. How'd they done that? Well, by picking grain, they'd harvest it. And by rubbing the grain in their hands and blowing the husk off, you know, they had winnowed and threshed. So in their minds, they had done what was unlawful. It was wrong. And so they made this accusation not to the disciples themselves, but to Jesus, who was responsible for his disciples. And so now, in all likelihood, the Pharisees weren't normally like hall monitors looking for people who were messing up. That's not the way that they normally acted. They weren't walking around looking for people to mess up. But they weren't fans of Jesus. Even up to this point in Matthew, we see that they believed Jesus had blasphemed by saying that he could forgive sins. He was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He didn't fast during the designated fast days. And they had actually already accused him of casting out demons by Beelzebul, the prince of demons. So for your everyday Jewish person, they didn't have to worry about the Pharisees following them around with a clipboard doing quality control on their every step. That's not what they had to worry about. But Jesus was in a different category. They didn't think Jesus was any good. And so they went around looking for evidence to confirm what they believed. And here it was. He didn't keep Sabbath. Now the issue that they actually have is not what Jesus addresses, at least, has more to do with his identity and his authority. He wants them to understand who he is and why that's a problem for what they're doing in accusing him of breaking Sabbath. They did have a major failure to understand what the law was about. And next week, we're going to see more of how he addresses that. This week, we're just going to see that he tells them, you don't understand the law, that I do understand the law. But more importantly, they didn't understand Jesus' relationship to the law. And because of that, they didn't understand their relationship to Jesus. So in these eight verses here, could summarize them as answering the question, who's in charge here? And by questioning Jesus about the Sabbath, the Pharisees are assuming that they're over Jesus. They're assuming that they're the experts and they can evaluate whether or not Jesus is keeping the law. They don't understand. that they're not in that position. They don't understand the situation. They don't understand the way things really are because they don't know Jesus. They don't know who he is. And so Jesus corrects them here, and Matthew is including this to correct us too, to correct our thinking. We need to understand that Jesus is the authority. We need to understand our relationship to this law by understanding our relationship to Jesus. And so Jesus is, again, going to give us three reasons why he's in charge of the Sabbath and really why he's in charge of the law and really why he's in charge of what's right and wrong. And so let's look at those three reasons here. And we want to look at them so that we think through, how is this going to impact us? How is this going to cause us to see Jesus the way that we should see him and the way that we should see ourselves in light of him? So the first reason Jesus is in charge of the law rather than the Pharisees is because Jesus has a greater understanding of the law. Look at verses 3 and 4. He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priests." So his first argument in addressing this charge is from 1 Samuel here. And so the Pharisees, they've laid down this charge that Jesus has broken the Sabbath by proxy. So he's authorized his disciples to do what they're doing. And because of that, he had broken the law, broke the Sabbath. And so Jesus, in order to address this, he points out something that doesn't fit with their understanding of the law. He points out something that in their way that they viewed the law, this didn't fit. And the way that he specifically went about that would have been like nails on a chalkboard to these folks. Because notice how he starts by asking, "Have you read?" These are the Pharisees. Of course they've read it. So by asking that question, "Have you not read?" He's pointing out, look, you supposed experts, you missed something. Your conception of the law is this way, but you missed something kind of big here. And then he draws their attention to this situation with David in 1 Samuel. David's running from Saul. Saul's trying to kill him. And he arrives at the tabernacle. And when he gets there, he and his men are tired, they're exhausted, they need some refreshment, and they go to Ahimelech here, the priest. And all that Ahimelech had was what was in the tabernacle. In the tabernacle, there were these 12 large loaves of bread that they would replace every Sabbath. And the only person who was supposed to eat those loaves were the priests. They were to bake those loaves, set them out on the Sabbath, and they were supposed to eat the loaves from the previous week. That was all that he had to offer him for food. And so he offered David and his men this holy bread. And they ate that bread that only the priests were allowed to eat. So Jesus is making the point that according to the law, David and his men weren't allowed to eat the bread that they ate. And yet, they weren't wrong. Now, the Pharisees know that David's not a perfect person. They know David's got problems, but they also know that when Uzzah reached out to touch the Ark of the Covenant, he died. When Aaron's two sons offered incense, offered offerings to the Lord that weren't in the law, they died. So this is the tabernacle. This is a holy place, a holy thing. If they have done something wrong, this is one of those things that God's going to immediately deal with. And nothing happens to David. Nothing happens to Ahimelech. So they're drawing out this, obviously there's a problem here in your understanding of the law. He's not saying, well, see, David broke the law, so it's okay for me to break the law. That's not his argument. His argument is that this doesn't fit with the way that you view God's law. Here's something that's going to help you understand that the way that you think about the law isn't right. The law revealed God's character. The law was a revelation of who God is. But it wasn't exhaustive. And God doesn't have those ads at the end of prescription drug commercials after every law saying, oh, this is going to be an exception over here and over here and over here. So he did give out his law, but there were some exceptions to that. Those exceptions, though, weren't contradictions. They fit with his character, too. They fit with the spirit of the law. They fit with what God was doing in the law. So they weren't inconsistent. They weren't contradictory. God's intention with the law that only the priest should eat this bread evidently did not include everyone under those categories. So someone who was anointed by God, as David was, for holy purposes, could actually fit the same place, same situation as Ahimelech the priest. He could be an exception and fit the spirit of what God was intending for that law. This is holy bread, and because I've anointed David, it can be used for holy purposes to preserve the Holy One, the Anointed One. That would fit still what God was doing, even with what he said in Leviticus 24, and saying that this is a holy portion. He's not contradicting himself by giving it to somebody else who's set apart for God. Now that's problematic though, because the way that the Pharisees understood things, they thought that they could take all the data and they could extrapolate out, well, okay, then this is what we need to do in order to make ourselves righteous. If I follow all these laws, then I can be righteous for God. That was never the intention of the law. Law was never supposed to make us righteous. So from that perspective, they weren't going to extrapolate the right way. They weren't going to figure out all the different inferences. They weren't going to understand how David doesn't contradict the law. They thought they understood these rules for Sabbath, but they didn't actually know the person that these rules were about. They didn't understand the rules because they didn't understand who the rules were actually about. Jesus has a greater understanding of the law because he knew who the law was about. Remember back in chapter 11, just the last thing that we talked about a couple weeks ago, verse 27 says, "No one knows the Father except the Son." The Son knows who the law was about. The law was a revelation of God's righteousness. So any understanding of righteousness has to come from an understanding of who God is. Only the Son knows the Father. He knows the law better than the Pharisees. He understands the law better than them. And he knew that his disciples had not broken Sabbath. And he demonstrated that by pointing out he understands how the law isn't contradicted in David's experience, but the Pharisees didn't. So he's just giving them an opportunity to say, I know how this works. You don't. I understand the law in ways that you do not understand. And that should have been enough to give them some questions. It's to give some pause in questioning Jesus. That's not the only evidence Jesus puts forward here. He also explains that he understands the law in a greater way than they did, but Jesus also has a greater knowledge of the circumstances. Look at verses 5 and 6. "Or have you not read in the law how on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here." So he moves on in his argument, and he gives them another seeming contradiction, this time within the law itself. And once again, it's like nails on the chalkboard, because what are they actually addressing with Jesus? They're addressing the law, and he's saying, you missed something in the law itself. You're supposed to be experts, but you missed something even in the law itself. You missed this reality that the priests break the Sabbath every Sabbath. The Sabbath is where you rest from your labors. The priests don't rest from their labors. They actually work more on the Sabbath. They're baking the bread and setting it out, like Leviticus 24 mentions. Numbers 28 says that they have an additional sacrifice. They're normally sacrificing in the morning and the evening, a burnt offering along with a grain offering and a drink offering. But they're doing a sacrifice in addition to that. So far from resting from their labors, they're doing more labors. They profane the Sabbath. They're not keeping the Sabbath laws. And yet, they're innocent. They're guiltless. And Jesus, again, isn't saying, look at how God contradicted himself. He's not pointing to a contradiction. He's pointing out that their understanding of the law is flawed. This exception points to this hierarchy in the law, that for the priests, serving in the temple was a higher priority than keeping the Sabbath laws. That for them, they were not supposed to rest from their labors. They were supposed to actually do more, and that was perfectly just and fair. That is perfectly right, rather, according to the law. So Jesus understood the circumstances It wasn't enough to just know the rules. It's not enough to just know, oh, this is what the law says. We have to understand the situation to apply the rules to. And Jesus understood there's a time when the rules apply in this particular case, and there's other cases where that rule does not apply. And so that's what he's drawing attention to. So we need to understand that too. You have to understand your circumstances if you're going to apply the law correctly. The Pharisees didn't understand the circumstances. They didn't understand the law correctly, and they didn't understand what they were standing there observing. They missed it. And that means that they shouldn't have been critiquing Jesus. The circumstances that Jesus is drawing attention to, he is cryptic. So Jesus doesn't spell everything out completely. He's a little cryptic in how he points this out. But after pointing out that in the temple, the Sabbath laws don't apply in the same way, he says something greater than the temple is here. And he actually puts an exclamation point on that because he says, I tell you at the beginning of it. That was the way to show that this was a solemn pronouncement. This was an important statement that something greater than the temple is here. Now he says something rather than someone. And that's not what we would expect, because it does seem pretty obvious that he's referring to himself. And that's why actually later copyists, when they were recording this, they got to this point in the gospel, they thought it was a mistake. And so they did in later copies change that to someone instead of something. And so that's why you have an older, an earlier English translations, it says one greater than the temple. That's what you'd expect Jesus to say. Someone greater in the temple is here. But that's not what he says, because Jesus is making a comparison between two different situations. He's comparing the situation with the temple to their own situation with his presence. He's saying something greater than the temple is here. And the Pharisees had no idea what they were actually in the presence of. They had no idea the significance of Jesus. And as Matthew puts it earlier in his book, this is God with us. This is Emmanuel. John began his gospel talking about this when he says the word became flesh and dwelt among us. The word in verse 1 of chapter 1 of John is divine. The word is God. So this divine word became human, became flesh and blood, and he dwelt among us. That word dwelt is a word that it's very fitting to use with tense. It's an allusion to Jesus being the true tabernacle, that tent of God's dwelling. Jesus is a greater tabernacle, a human tabernacle. And as Paul puts it in Colossians, in Jesus, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. So something greater than the temple was right there, and they had no idea. They had no idea the situation. They had no idea the circumstances. It's like they were arguing with the temple itself, saying, you're breaking the Sabbath rules. It's nonsense. Something greater than the temple was there. In God's presence, there were certain rules that applied and certain rules that didn't. Well, God's presence was there in an even greater way. So they missed it. They did not understand the circumstances. They didn't understand the law. But more importantly, they didn't actually have any authority. They thought that they were in authority to be able to judge Jesus, but they didn't. They were kind of like a self-proclaimed police officer who's telling an actual police officer that he's, or trying to give an actual police officer a ticket for parking illegally. And the police officer would be saying something like, well, you have three problems here. One, you don't understand the law. The law has to do with parking during the weekdays. Two, you don't understand the circumstances. This is the weekend. But three, you're not actually a police officer. I am. So he's saying, you're not actually in charge. I am. That's what we see in the last section here. So let's look at that. Last point, Jesus has a greater understanding of the law. He has a greater knowledge of the circumstances, but Jesus has a greater authority. Look at verse 7 and 8. And if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. So again, each of the previous two started with, have you not read? I mean, he's just kind of sticking it to him there by saying, you missed something. You're supposed to be experts. Well, here he just flat out tells them, You got it wrong. He says, if you had known what this means. What he means is, you don't know what this means. But if you had known what it means, then you wouldn't have done what you did. You would not have condemned the disciples. And what is he pointing at? He's pointing at what he talked about actually back in chapter 9, verse 13. Hosea 6:6 says, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Now back in Hosea's day, God was not saying, I don't want you to sacrifice. He was saying that if you don't have mercy, if you don't have the right attitude as you're sacrificing him, they're worthless. There was something more foundational than the act itself. Just sacrificing wasn't good enough. You had to have the right attitude. You had to understand what that sacrifice represented and to that to accompany it. So imagine if I wronged Laura in a way. Let's say I talked negatively about her to my friends, and then she found out about it, and she confronted me. Suppose when she confronted me, I said, oh, I am sorry. Please forgive me. How would she feel if I just gave the automated response? If I didn't mean it? It's the right thing to do if you mean it. And if I really meant it, I wouldn't just apologize to her. I'd actually go talk to my friends and say, you know what? I shouldn't have done that. So you can't just go through the motions and act a certain way and say, oh, I'm going to do these rules. The law intended, God intended through the law for us to mean it. And that's what Jesus is getting at. So the Pharisees, they don't really understand the law because their motives aren't right. The motives for carrying out the law aren't correct. And because of that, they weren't going to see properly. They weren't going to understand Jesus and his situation correctly. They didn't understand the law from the right motives. If they had the right motives, the law, as they went to it and then looked at Jesus, they would have realized the law is pointing to Jesus. If they had the right motives when they looked at the law, they would have recognized Jesus. They would have recognized who he is. They would have recognized that he's not doing the wrong thing if they had the right kind of motives. So instead, they had condemned the innocent. And this is the first time Jesus actually says explicitly, my disciples are innocent in this. They haven't done anything wrong. They're guiltless. And he says, again, if you had recognized, if you had understood the law, he's kind of leaving out a step here, you would have recognized me and you would not have condemned my followers. Why not? Because the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. If they had understood the law, recognized that Jesus is the Son of Man, they would have recognized that he's in charge of the law. He's making a claim there that he is actually in authority over the Sabbath. By implication, he's in authority over the law. So keep in mind what Jesus is referring to when he calls himself the Son of Man. This comes from Daniel 7. This is the end time judge. Everything's going to be handed over to the Son of Man. He's going to have dominion and authority over everyone else. And so this Son of Man is the one who's in charge of using the law to condemn others. He's not being condemned by the law. He's adjudicating the law. He's not on trial. And so what the Pharisees had not understood is that they'd gotten the picture all wrong. They had assumed that Jesus was just like them and that they could essentially take Jesus to court. You know, they could say, hey, you're doing something wrong. We're going to take you to court. They didn't realize that Jesus is the judge. And by virtue of being in his presence, it's like they're in the courtroom. So they're sitting before the bench. Jesus is sitting on the bench. It makes no sense if you're in that situation to turn things around and say, all right, I'm going to put the judge. I'm going to take the judge to court. No, you're the one on trial. They didn't understand their circumstances. They didn't understand who Jesus was. Now, you could respond to that and say, well, you know, even judges, they're under the law, then they have to abide by the law. That's true, because our judges, it's just an analogy, but our judges are just like us. They get their power from the same place. They get their power from our government, our governing rules and the system and the way it works. That's not how God's law works. That's not how right and wrong works. So understand, how does the Bible talk about what makes something right and wrong? The Bible does not say something is right and wrong just because God arbitrarily said so. The Bible actually teaches that things are right and wrong because they fit with who God is. That there is not some law outside of our universe that even God has to abide by. There is no law that God has to abide by. Understanding of right and wrong only comes from who God is. We are not supposed to lie because God is a God of truth. So anything that is wrong is only wrong because it doesn't fit with who God is. Anything that's right is only right because it fits with who God is. That's how this works. That's how our situation is. So because of that, the only way to truly and rightly know what is right and wrong is to know God. You cannot actually know what is right and wrong if you don't know God, because he's the standard. And that's where Adam and Eve went wrong. And they tried to determine right and wrong for themselves. God had said, it's wrong to eat from the tree. Adam and Eve said, it's right for me. That's not how we determine right and wrong. God is the one who determines that. And that's the same thing that you find in the book of Judges. The book of Judges has these two statements that you see. In the first part of the book, and really the main part, it repeatedly talks about how Israel did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And then at the end of the book, it has this other phrase. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. What is evil in God's eyes is right in our own eyes. Which eyes matter? God's eyes are the ones that matter. They're the determining factor. And why is that? Because God's the creator. So God created everything that exists. All of our existence is tied to God and his existence. His existence makes everything else. It's all dependent on him. And because of that, he has the authority to determine what's right and what's wrong. So if we bring this back to Jesus, Jesus has authority over God's law because he is God. He's the standard itself. In a very real way, Jesus is the law. That's why he has authority over it. He has authority to dictate what is right and wrong because what is right and wrong is who he is. So that's the amazing thing. When you think about Jesus, he's the incarnation of right and wrong. And when you realize that, something really amazing has happened. So we imagine, like Adam and Eve, you know, we can figure out right and wrong for ourselves. We do what's right in our own eyes. Without realizing that apart from a creator, there's no such thing as right or wrong. Right and wrong don't exist apart from someone dictating what is right and wrong. You know, this group over here can say this is right, and this group can say this is wrong. They have no authority. It's all just opinion, unless there's a creator. God made us, and God is good. So God created us. He's what accounts for everything, and he determines what's right and wrong in his world. And that's it. There's no other way to determine it. God determines what's right and what's wrong. And here's the reality. We were never intended to try to figure that out on our own. We were never intended to get to some point of maturity, you know, like God had made Adam and Eve and said, well, one day you'll be able to grow up and figure out right and wrong for yourself. We were intended to live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. God was always supposed to be an intimate part of our life and the determining factor of what is right and wrong. So when God evaluates us, verdict's already in. We're wrong. Why are we wrong? Why are we in the wrong in what we do? Because we're not connected to God. We're separated from God. We're trying to live life by ourselves. When you try to live life by yourself, you are not going to do what is right. Because the only way to do what is right is to do that, to take action in fellowship with God. It's the only way. You have to be in connection with God, with the one who determines that. You cannot. God never intended us to go it alone. Never intended us to figure things out for ourselves. That's why the world has gone all wanky, the way that it's gone. It's because we're trying to figure out right and wrong for ourselves. We're miserable failures at it, corporately and individually. But here's the thing. This God, who could have just as easily scrapped the whole thing. I mean, he could have easily just said, that's it. They're going away. I'm just going to punish them because they've wandered off. He didn't do that. The standard for right and wrong actually became one of us. He came a flesh and blood, air-breathing, heart-beating human. The judge became a man named Jesus. And that man, instead of condemning us for wandering, which he will do one day, but instead of doing that when he came, he actually did everything necessary to restore us to God. Everything necessary to save us from the punishment we deserve and save us from our wandering from him. So in his living and dying and rising again, he did everything necessary to forgive us for our sins and to bring us back to God, to make us right with God. And he did that for everyone who will recognize that we are wrong, that we're in the wrong, and who turn and trust in what he's done, in his life, death, and resurrection. We trust in him to restore us, to make us right with God. We don't try to make ourselves right so that God will accept us. We come to Jesus so that in trusting in what he's done, he accepts us on the basis of his own actions. And we trust in him. So stop trying to live life the way that you think is best. Seems kind of a backwards thing to hear from the pulpit. Stop trying to live in the way that you think is best, because you're not going to be good at it. And instead, come to the one who's the authority on the subject, who knows what is right and wrong. Recognize you're wrong. Trust in the one who came to make you right through his life, death, and resurrection. And if you are living for Jesus, if you have turned from wandering off, if you are trusting in Jesus alone to make you right with God, you need to remember that Jesus is still in charge. He's still the one who determines right and wrong. You can never start to think that we can figure out what is right and wrong apart from God and apart from Jesus. We should never imagine, and I know we may never get to this place, but maybe we do. We should never try to analyze right and wrong without listening to Jesus. We should never make allowances for murder with what Jesus says is murder because it'd be more convenient for us or because it would guarantee equality among two genders. We don't have the authority to determine who is a person. We don't have the authority to bequeath God's image on someone. God did that. What's left to us is merely to acknowledge what God has done and submit to him. And there could be some other things. There's no doubt other things that we might question God, the Father, and the Son, and the Spirit on. But we can never judge the judge. The only way that we can come to understand what is right and what is wrong is to know him through his Son. So Jesus has argued for that. He argues that he's in charge. He understands the law. He knows the circumstances for applying it. Most importantly, he has the authority to spell it out for us. So we need to listen to him. Regardless of what the culture might say about gender or marriage or anything else, we don't have the right or even the opportunity to question what Jesus has said. We need to listen to what Jesus has said. We need to submit to him. He's the one who's in charge. Join me in prayer. Father, there are a lot of voices in our world that would question the ethics that we find in your word, the morality that we find in your word. And it's easy with all the many people who are getting on board with some of these different beliefs and different moralities, that be easy for us to feel the pressure to cave. Everybody around us is saying, this is right, this is right, this is right. Or doing what's right in their own eyes. And it is so hard, Father, to stand our ground, to listen to your Son, to not cave, especially in light of the way that we can be vilified for doing that. So, Father, I pray that you would convict our hearts that the one who's in charge of all these things is you. Your Son is the one that we should look to, that we should listen to. Pray that you would embolden us in that way, that we would not become faint-hearted, that we would not become weak-willed and cave to the pressures of our society, that we would recognize that we cannot figure out right and wrong on our own, that you are the one who determines what is right and what is wrong. I pray that you would grant us the grace we need to stand firmly, to hold firmly to that, to trust your Son in everything that he says, everything that you have said in your word. Father, I pray for those that may not know you, who may be trying to just do what's best, have imagined that they can try to be good on their own so that you'll accept them. Father, I pray that you would reveal to them that there is no possible way for us on our own to do what is right, to do what is acceptable in your sight. That was never an option. That they would instead recognize that they are not doing what's right. That they would come to Jesus. That they would recognize that Jesus is how we can be right with you. In Jesus alone, that they would trust in him alone to save them, to rescue them, to make them right with you. And only then attempt to live for you because of what your Son has done. Pray that you would do that even this morning. We ask this through your Son. Amen.